One-on-One. I'm Charles Woolforth for our weekly coffee house conversation. And this week, Shotzi Schaefer is my guest. She's a playwright. She's a radio personality. She's an actor, dramatist, somebody who's been in Anchorage for a long time. Yet, I'm betting that most people don't necessarily know who you are for all the things that you've done.
I don't know. Well, now. Of course.
Yeah, now they will, right?
You're raising my profile.
Although they may know your voice from the radio, mm-hmm. and a lot of people have seen your plays. But the playwright is not necessarily always the star that you think about.
You're right, it's a tangential role in most cases.
Or it's not the person who's up front and in the middle.
Right.
And so how many plays have you written in total?
I'm not entirely sure, but as far as full-length plays, I only have three that are, you know, finished and not hiding under the bed. But I've written a lot of short plays. That's really what I enjoy doing the most. And so I probably have 40 short plays and maybe about 20 10-minute plays.
Mm-hmm. And you said that you got started in writing plays with this, what is it called, the 24-hour?
Oh, Alaska Overnighters, which we've been doing now for 10 years. I think coming up this August will be our 10-year anniversary of producing Overnighters at least twice a year. And so I'm a producer on that project as
and
well.
And so the concept is that, are you given a theme or are you just given?
Yeah, usually you're given some sort of theme or inspiration. Sometimes it's just a prop, or maybe you're given a painting or a line out of a poem or a song, something to inspire you to stay up all night and write a 10-minute play. And you're also given your cast and your director, and a lot of times...
And they get to sleep while you're writing.
Right, exactly. But then they spend all day putting the show together, and so it all happens within a 24-hour period. But in a lot of cases, the cast that you get ends up being more inspirational than anything else, because you have to write for specific people.
Sure.
And so a lot of times that's where your story comes from, when you build the characters first.
And so that's sort of when you got your first buzz, when you saw your words on stage being performed.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
Yeah, that was in, I think that was 2002, so it was our second Overnighters. And I was actually living in Washington State, but had come up to visit, and it was good timing because it was an opportunity to be involved. And I had written some plays, but not really done anything with them. And so I wrote a 10-minute play, and it was more exciting than anything I've ever done in terms of being on stage, because I'm an actress as well and a director. But sitting in the house waiting for the show to start and seeing the furniture go into place for my play, I was absolutely panicked, but in a really great way. And to see it on its feet and see it happening was really exciting for me and inspired me to turn around and immediately start writing more plays.
Yeah.
And then producing them eventually.
And was it humor? Was it comedy?
Yeah, it was.
So getting to see your laugh lines actually produce laughs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty exciting when you realize that something's actually working. Yeah.
And so I'm glad the first one worked, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you would have hidden your head and never
come back. Right, and maybe I never would have done it again.
So 10-minute plays, is there a big market for 10-minute plays?
Actually, yeah. And it's not that you can make a living off of it, but if you want to get your plays produced, if you want to get that experience, which that's the best way to really grow as a writer, is to see your work on its feet and to see how it works and how audiences respond to it. And there are lots of opportunities around the nation to get your plays done in 10-minute play festivals. A lot of theaters will do those sorts of things kind of as a fundraiser almost, because they're pretty cheap to put together and involve lots of people. So they'll sell a lot of tickets because they have a lot of actors involved. And in the process, they get to champion a lot of different playwrights. And so on the occasions that I've been able to fly to various cities and see my 10-minute plays done or one-act plays done, I've gone. But, you know, obviously can't go all the time.
Oh, that's too bad. So how many have been performed in other cities?
I'd say probably maybe 15 or 20.
Wow. I mean, that's a pretty great level of success for being sort of under the radar.
Right, depending on how you measure success. But yeah, it's exciting.
Well,
and
most of
you...
us produce art of one kind or another, and we're lucky if our family puts up with
exactly.
this, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've written books, and you know what it's like, because I've written some books as well. I wrote a few young adult fiction novels, and it's really hard just to get somebody to read your book.
Yeah.
And so having, you know, hundreds of people actually get to see your work is really rewarding.
Oh, it's got to be. Yeah, it's like in publication, but... You get the feedback right away and the applause and all that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as how you write a funny play. You know, I talked to Chad Carpenter, the cartoonist, about how do you force yourself to be funny? You know, and that if you think about, oh my gosh, I've got to be funny, like that's the worst time to be funny. But here you've got to sit down at a typewriter or a computer and and be funny? And how do you do that?
Well, it comes pretty naturally. I'd say that there are times when I try to avoid it. Mm-hmm. There's times when I sit down and go, okay, this is going to be a serious play. And no matter how serious the subject matter, it always ends up having a lot of comedic moments. Mm-hmm. It always ends up having a sense of humor to it. So I think that's just how my brain works. Mm. I've been in radio for a long time as well, and you're required to be funny on a pretty consistent basis. And so I think it's just something that's always come naturally to me, and as an actor as well.
Mm. So were you that kind of kid that was like full of wit and,
Yeah, I think so. A little bit of a class clown. Uh-huh. I think that it was sort of a coping mechanism that I think maybe I inherited from my brother, really. No matter what kind of turmoil or anything that was going on when we were kids, he was always able to take a funny approach to it. And so I think that I caught on to that at a pretty young age. Mm-hmm. And so no matter how dark the subject matter that I'm writing, I always see the humor in it.
Mm. There's kind of a universal family rule that a kid, if the kid does what he does is funny, then he's not going to get in trouble, right?
I don't know about that.
Humor will get you off almost anything.
Not always, no.
Yeah. So do you grow up here in Anchorage?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I was born here in Anchorage, moved to the Valley when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and we lived out there for 10 years in Palmer, and then moved mm-hmm. back to Anchorage and finished high school here.
Okay, but you didn't get into drama as a high school student?
No, not really. I mean, I took an acting class, I think, but didn't really get seriously interested until I was a student at UAA and was planning to major in music, and in my second year, just for fun, I decided to take an acting class because it was something I was always interested in but not really brave enough to do.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty instantly switched my major. Again, it was the first time that I actually got on stage in a play and had that experience of audience feedback that I went, mm-hmm. oh wow, there's something here. This is going to change my whole life. I mean, I remember driving home that night from my first performance.
What was your role?
I actually played 14 different characters in a play from the 60s called Adaptation that was written by Elaine May. It was a great opportunity to dive in and do a comedy right away and have to play so many different roles. I played mm-hmm. all of the women in this one guy's life. It was sort of a game show of a man's life.
Fun.
And I played, you know, his mother and all of his girlfriends and wife.
Mm-hmm. And so you're driving home and you just have this high.
Which
is coming from... Do you think it's coming from, I mean, is there a narcissistic aspect?
Yeah,
people
course.
Are clapping for me, or is it coming more from the creative thing? I've gone out there and done what I wanted to do.
Well, I think all of that's true. I mean, sure, obviously it feeds your ego, and especially when you're 19 years old and have never mm-hmm. had that kind of attention before. But uh-huh. I just knew that I was onto something. I knew that, I mean, we'd been rehearsing this play, and none of us were even aware that it was very funny. We thought we were going to be this huge bomb. And we get up and do it in front of everybody, and people really responded to it. And I still get people mentioning it. To this day, people will mention that play.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I knew that my life had changed, and it was something I was always going to do in one way or another. I didn't realize I was going to become a playwright at that point, mm-hmm. but I knew I was going to stay in theater forever.
Did you do many dramatic roles, or did you mm-hmm. ever stick to comedy?
No, I've done a lot of dramatic roles as well. In fact, I really, as a performer, because I don't act very much anymore, but as a performer, I really prefer to do the dramatic roles now. Mm-hmm. This is harder for me. It's much more challenging. When you can connect that way, that's a big deal. You know, people say mm-hmm. comedy's hard, but really, I think the drama's much harder.
I want to ask a question, and it's a weird question, because I feel like this is something everybody else knows, and I don't.
Okay.
But there's this thing that happens when something is really good on stage, where you have this suspension of disbelief and you mm-hmm. actually kind of move into the play in some sense.
You forget that you're watching.
You forget
it,
you're watching the play. And it's much easier to do in a movie because it's more immersive. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got this complete setting. And I guess, do you, when you're watching good drama, does that happen to you? Or are you kind
of... Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, I still get excited every time I go see a play. When you're waiting for the lights to dim,
you forget that you're watching actors. You forget you're in a theater.
If it's good, yeah, yeah. If it's really good and it draws uh-huh. me in and makes me forget that I'm just watching actors on stage.
Well, what does it take to do that? I mean, what's the magic thing that allows you to do that? You've directed, you've acted, you've been.
I wish I knew exactly what it is. I mean, I know when I see it, uh-huh. right? You know when you see it.
Yeah. Do you think it's something about honesty, or what is it? I mean, is it?
Yeah, I suppose it's the truth of it. It's the truth of the scene, or the truth of what's going on with the characters, and if the actors are conveying that, and the script is really dead on, and the director has managed to bring that script to life, you know, mm-hmm. and really understands the material. When all those things come together, that's what happens.
Yeah. Well, as a playwright, do you feel like you've got to connect to something from within yourself, mm-hmm. with your own life, in order to go there and bring that about?
Yeah, absolutely. Although I wouldn't say that, you know, very many of my plays are autobiographical. For the most part, I take my inspiration from events that happen in the news. So my plays tend to be very, very contemporary because, like, for instance, one of my plays is a fictional account of what happened with Enron and really what happened to the people who were victimized by it in terms of the blackouts that happened in California. I was really interested in that topic and was really interested in the people who were affected by it more than the people who caused it to happen. And so that inspired me to write a play. And even though it's thinly veiled, you know, you can tell if you know anything about Enron that that's what it's about, even though I never say the word and changed all the names.
So did you do research to bring that about? Or?
Yeah, I did mountains of research, yes. Read a lot of the transcripts, actually, between the traders for Enron and some of the appalling things that they were saying on the phone to each other in discussion of the sorts of things they were doing that were affecting the West Coast and how they were so disconnected from it and did not care at all. And so I was thinking about those people, and, you know, the people way down the chain, people sitting there in the dark in their apartments.
And somehow bringing that to life without being preachy and, you know, I mean, because that would be the risk of something like that, I would think.
Right. But I think that, you know, you get a few minutes into it and realize it's a very funny play, even though it's incredibly dark, obviously. That's a very dark topic. And a lot of people lost a lot of money, and some people were put at risk health-wise. But again, I just always managed to find some funny undercurrent.
There is something funny about these people upstream who are like treating people like marionettes. So, in creating something like that, you are trying to get inside the characters and bring their voices out. I mean, is each character a different entity in your mind, and you're thinking about how that person would talk?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hear their speech patterns in my mind, and you know, they all. I don't really have to think about it that much because that comes pretty naturally to me to hear the different ways that people would speak depending on where they're from and what their socioeconomic conditions are.
So, but you've got to create a mental model of each character in order to stay with the way they would talk, what they would be thinking.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time developing the characters before I ever start writing any scenes.
And how is that done? Is that like you're driving down the road and you're thinking about the person, and when you get there you make a note or something?
Yeah, I'll go through it, especially with the full-length plays, because that takes so much more consideration of where you're going with the script and the outline of the script. Or the short play, sometimes I'll just have an idea and sit down and write the whole thing in one evening or write it over a few days, where I'm much more careful with the full-length play. That's why I say I have three completed full-length plays that I'm willing to show people, because I have some others that maybe I just got excited and started writing it and realized halfway through I didn't have a roadmap. And it's a little too late now to go back and try to fix it, so I'll just go, okay, that was a writing exercise, and start something else. But I do spend a great deal of time on character before I even start to address the outline.
Well, I think that a lot of people think that when writers write, they don't know where they're going and it just appears on the page. Very, very few writers get to do that.
Right.
Most writers, if they can do anything worthwhile, it's all got to be structured. You got to really know where you're going. So you start with characters, you start with a situation, you start with some kind of a premise. What's the actual seed or the kernel?
Gosh, it really depends on the play, but in most cases it's really the characters are where it begins. And then, you know, what do they
want?
What
if there was a person like this person I know, or what if there was a person that sort of are you drawing it from somebody you've met, or what's the...
Maybe, sometimes. I'll inform those characters based on people that I've known in my life. Sometimes it's just doing a lot of reading about somebody.
So, you mentioned reading these transcripts of the Enron thing.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered, you know, I've read transcripts too as a journalist, and I've done interviews and read transcripts, and I've often wondered if good dialogue that's written in a movie or play is like a transcript, or if you're actually, in the creative process, you're adding something to the dialogue which isn't totally naturalistic in order to get
something
across.
Oh, that's true. In order to get something across and in order to make the scene move forward, because if I actually wrote the transcripts the way that they were written, I mean, people stammer and don't talk in complete sentences, and it would probably be really difficult to watch.
They don't know where they're going, they don't understand each other, they get mixed up, they go the wrong direction.
Right.
And it takes a long time. And sometimes it's interesting to read that just to see what it's really like and how different it is from a lot of what we see.
Right. People don't speak with the point of trying to reach a climax of the conversation and some sort of resolution, but that's what you have to
have. But on the other hand, if it's too obvious you're doing that, then you've got bad dialogue.
Right. Yes.
So yeah. How long did it take you to develop the ability to write good dialogue? I mean, when you look back at your early stuff, do you think you've ever cringed?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. If I look at my earlier plays, because now and then I'll see an opportunity to send a play out, you know, and I see the submission opportunities, and they'll be looking for a play on a particular genre, and I go, oh, I have that one play I wrote 5 years ago. And I go back and look at it and end up spending more time rewriting it than I did writing it in the first place, because I think, oh, gosh, that's... I think that the thing that most playwrights do, the mistake that we make to begin with, no matter how long you've been doing this, when you write your first draft, your characters tend to be really obvious and state, they make statements about their character or statements about what they want, as opposed to finding
nobody ever really does.
Right, as opposed to finding subtextual ways to get that across. Uh-huh. And so when we rewrite our plays, or at least for me, that's the very first thing I do, is look for statements of fact and try to find other ways to convey that information rather than just having the character say it.
Well, I'm going to make a statement
that's boring.
Of fact.
Yeah.
This is Charles Wolforth, the show is one-on-one. Little exposition here. Yeah. I'm talking to playwright Shotzi Schaffers, who's also a local radio personality, and has done a lot of interesting stuff. Yeah. And we're just having a great conversation as two writers about how you do your craft. Now, I attended a play that you put on, part of your four-play series, where you do four one-acts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you directed some of them. You hadn't written all of them, as you've done in the past.
Right.
And some of the past ones, you wrote all four, directed all four, which is an amazing accomplishment.
It's crazy is what it is, and I'll never do that again. But I'm glad I did it.
In this particular one, the one act that you had written was about a young woman who's trying to make an independent film.
Right.
And
that's called The Cross.
Yeah, and she's trying to do this scene, and this funder comes along, and he wants to put his nephew or
something. Yeah, his untalented nephew
into the thing. It keeps ruining it, and she's like putting up with it and putting up with it because she didn't want to offend her funder. And finally her actors leave, and then her funder leaves and says, I never meant to give you the money anyway. And she's totally devastated and loses the whole thing. And as I was watching that, I was thinking, I wonder if there's sort of a little autobiographical element here of just the frustration of doing your work and having to deal with people who don't get it or who don't support it or whatever. I mean, do you, the frustrations that are shown in that, are those frustrations that you have to go through?
Oh, to some extent. I mean, I think with every writer, you experience that. You know, I mean, there's nothing direct, you know, in relation to my life in that play, but I would say it's definitely a metaphor for what a lot of artists go through. Mm-hmm. You can't just write in isolation for yourself. I mean, I suppose you can, but if you want to actually put your work on stage and have it get some sort of recognition, you do have to keep in mind the audience and what their expectations are, as well as the people who are promoting your work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes those expectations are positive and they guide you in the direction of being a better artist. But in this particular case, it's obvious that she's being destroyed by the outside.
Right, her film will absolutely not get made unless this man...
Unless she panders to this guy.
Right,
And to... have you run into that, where the forces that you have to deal with are not letting you do what you want to do?
Not very much, really. I've been very lucky. I've been very nurtured, you know, in a lot of the situations I've been in, including situations where I was writing under grant deadlines and writing for a project that was grant-funded. Now, in those... One particular case, I wrote a play by working with women at Aquila and Glenwood Center, women who were in recovery from substance abuse, and I was commissioned by Aquila to write specifically about that, but I was given total freedom as to what I ended up writing. No one ever told me at any point what I could or couldn't write, so it was a really great situation. Would I have gone ahead and written a play about a woman who gets caught, you know, with this huge meth lab, you know, on my own? Probably not, but it was a great inspiration to go ahead and do that, to talk to these women and understand their lives and decide that that's what I wanted to write. So that was great. It could have gone another way. I've heard of writers writing for grant-funded projects and being told, oh, no, you can't do this. You have to do it like this. Oh, you can't say that. That would you know, reflect negatively on the organization. Have you been there? Yeah.
Yeah, and it feels even worse than being influenced by an advertiser, because you don't feel like it's right.
It's not genuine.
But it's still, you know, a nonprofit organization. They're trying to do something positive, but you disagree with them, and so it's more, in a way, it's easier to deal with it, some advertiser who's trying to influence you. So you, in the mornings, are on the radio.
Yeah, I do a morning radio program on Light 105.7. It's a light rock station.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so this is your day job,
yeah.
You know, because you're not making
one
your
of them,
as a playwright.
Yeah.
Right, and the other is?
Yeah, I cobble it all together. Well, I also do freelance grant writing, mostly for arts organizations, and I do voice work.
Oh, for like commercials?
Commercials, yeah.
And
TV
would
and
we
radio.
Ever see you on a TV commercial?
Yeah, actually, I did some TV commercials in the last year for Lithia and Brown Jug.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is that fun?
Sure, yeah, and it's easy money. I mean, you usually spend one day shooting it.
Uh-huh.
And especially when they come out good. When they're well-produced, that's good, because other times, if you do a commercial and it doesn't come out very well, you know how it is with local TV commercials. You kind of wish you could just give the money back for them to stop playing it.
Yeah, and over and over again. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had that experience, so I'm selective when it comes to anything on camera.
Yeah. Do you find any overlap between your radio work and your dramatic work? I mean, is there anything about those two things that's the same?
Yeah, I think that one has informed the other throughout my entire career. I think that having to be spontaneous and be on my feet every morning, you know, most people don't roll out of bed and have to be funny and, you know, hold up a mirror to what's going on in society. And so I think that doing that makes it much easier for me to come up with ideas for plays and to come up with dialogue.
Are you sincere when you're being on the radio? I mean, are you playing a part or are you being shot?
Probably too sincere sometimes. I have to really watch myself because I can be very honest.
Oh, really?
But I think that's probably one of my strengths is that I tend to bring my attitude on the air, and people will relate to that more than if you're just all sunshine all
being
the time.
Being kind of sassy and sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see that. So, and it's you're basically looking at the people page in the newspaper and bouncing off that?
Or? Right. I mean, you talk about local things that are going on as well as, you know, things that are happening with celebrities. You know, when Mel Gibson leaves somebody a hideous voicemail, we tend to talk about that the next day.
Uh-huh.
Or it's movies that are on or popular TV shows, that sort of thing. You have to talk about Dancing with the Stars, whether I actually watched it the night before or not.
Right.
Luckily, I have these prep services that show me what happened the night before. And so
tell me about that. I never heard of that
before. Yeah, these morning prep services that we use for morning radio, and pretty much everybody uses them, and they really they summarize kind of everything that's gone on in the last 48 hours in terms of popular culture.
Well, I'll be darned.
So I can look at these things and go, okay, I didn't actually see it last night, but I know that this person got voted off, and so I can talk about that.
So there's somebody in the country who's got a business where he's like, they're consuming popular culture, summarizing it, and sending it off to disc jockeys all over the
uh-huh.
country.
Somebody makes a lot of money doing that. And what's funny is a lot of those prep services come out of Great Britain. For whatever reason, there's a lot of comedy writers who write for morning radio in Great Britain. And so sometimes I have to pick through and go, okay, wait a minute. I'll see the language, you know, and there's some British phrase in there. And I'll go, okay, I'm not sure if I'm going to do this story because I'm not sure how.
You're not going to do a joke about a lorry or something.
Right. Exactly.
So, so that's interesting, because so all the little jokes, you don't have to come up with them. You're kind of being fed.
Well, I don't really take the jokes from the prep services so much as the ideas about what's out there and what's being talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I look at, okay, these are the situations that are going on, and these are the celebrities that are being talked about, and who's getting attention right now. But the humor I have to come up with it on my own. I can't deliver someone else's jokes. It just doesn't come across as sincere.
Yeah.
And I can tell. When I'm hearing people on the radio do that, I can tell.
Are you thinking jokes, Liney, thinking about what am I going to say about this? Is it funny, or does it tend to be just spontaneous?
I'm much more spontaneous. I know what I'm going to talk about. I don't always know where I'm going to go with it, especially because I have a radio partner, and so we bounce things off of each other. And so if one of us hits a high note, that's when you go into a song or go into commercials. And luckily, that's my radio partner's job more than it is mine because he runs the board.
And he is your partner on the radio?
Justin McDonald.
Okay.
Yeah.
And but I mean that we think of a disc jockey as being the person who's picking out the songs and putting them on. That's a thing of the past.
No, I've been in radio since 1994 and have never been able to pick my own music. I think that was something I thought in my first radio job. Oh, it'll be so cool! I can pick out the songs. You find out immediately that as soon as you play a song that wasn't on the list, you get a phone call from the program director. So they're always listening.
You got a bit into public radio.
You know, I actually did public radio very briefly at KNBA when I first moved back to Alaska about 8 years ago when I was looking for a job. A friend of mine said, well, I can get you on contract at KNBA for a little while. It was great. It was such a great experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, not so much because of the picking out of the music, because mm-hmm. I've always been more interested in discussing lifestyle and that sort of thing mm-hmm. than I have been in the musical end of it. But to really discover new music that way, to be yeah. playing songs that everyone isn't playing all of the time, and to to not have to talk about Dancing with the Stars, to talk about other sorts of topics yeah. was really great and a challenge, but at the same time really rewarding.
My first job out of high school was at KSKA, back when they played music and doing a noon, mm-hmm. noon show and doing interviews, and it was a lot of fun. So you got to do a piece with Perseverance Theater. That was kind of a highlight for you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's a new play that I wrote about a year and a half ago. I got a grant from the State Arts Council to work with a dramaturg in San Francisco to help me develop a new play. It's called Vashon. It takes place on Vashon Island in Washington. Mm-hmm. And right around the time that I was in the middle of writing that, I got a call from Art Roach at Perseverance Theater. And he said, you know, I keep hearing that we should be doing your plays. We want to do something of yours on our second stage. And so I sent him the full-length plays that I had written, and I also sent him the outline for Vashon, and he really liked that one mm-hmm. and said, okay, well, you know, send it to me as you develop it. And so about a year after that, I had the script had been through a number of readings and levels mm-hmm. of development, and I felt like it was ready to actually be put on a stage, even in a workshop setting. And so I went to Juno, January of 2011. I spent 3 weeks down there. They brought me down and produced the show on their second stage mm-hmm. With local actors who were fantastic. That's great. Really, really good.
Well, this has been a great conversation, at least for me. I've really enjoyed learning more about writing plays, and I appreciate so much you being
with us. Thank
you, Charles. Charles Woolforth. I've been talking to local playwright Shotzi Schaefers. Join us again next week. We'll have another Coffeehouse Conversation on One-on-One.
One-on-One is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated. John LaFournaise directs and edits the show. Pat Yak is the producer. Camera operators are Travis Gilmore and Josh Edge. One-on-One was filmed at Kaladi Brothers Cafe at JL Tower in Anchorage. You can watch One-on-One Sunday nights at 6:30 p.m. and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on Alaska Public Television, or listen Thursdays at 1 p.m. on KSKA. Tune in next week for One-on-One when Charles Woolforth interviews Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey. This is KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.